Good evening, everyone. I'm Asha Naiswamy, and we're going to continue with our class, Swami's wonderful book, In Divine Friendship. I'll say a prayer. Keshava will lead us in two chants, and then we'll have a few minutes of meditation. So please pray with me. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to feel your consciousness behind your words, Swamiji. Help us to feel your wisdom, your loving kindness, and your joy, that every word that you have written comes into our hearts and minds as a transforming beam of divine grace, helping us to draw ever closer to our everlasting home of perfect bliss. Om, peace. Amen.
Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Govinda Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Radha Ramana Hare Govinda Jai Jai Radha Ramana Hare Govinda Jai Jai Govinda Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Govinda Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Radha Ramana Hare Govinda 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 Jai Jai
occasionally we twist in it. Let's meditate now for a couple of minutes. Om, peace. Amen. All right, my friends, here we are again. And here we are with Swamiji. And we are finishing up the section called Thank You. And then we move into something else. And what comes next is marriage and renunciation. Is that what it's called? Marriage and renunciation. Well, that's an interesting title, but we'll see if we get there tonight. So, this letter is December 27th, 1998, and it's to a musician who sent a recording of his performance. Swami writes, "Today I had the time to listen with greater care to your recording. I want you to know I think it is exquisite. Thank you so much, not only for doing it, but for doing it with such deep sensitivity. The parts you feel might have been better are the eternal concern of every sincere artist, whether musician, singer, or writer. I still remember Longinus in his essay On the Sublime. He said, I'm paraphrasing, that the greatest works cannot but have minor technical flaws, because an excessive concern with the achievement of formal perfection prevents the mind from soaring in skies of inspiration." It's a really interesting statement, especially important that Swami puts his energy behind it. I think what's also really beautiful here is Swami says, "I listened with care to your recording. I want you to know I think it's exquisite." And I've mentioned in many contexts that Swami always spoke exactly what he felt. So that I don't know, I suspect I know who, oh my, here we have a fly. At this time of year, we get invaded by flies, and we have been battling them all day. I wish I could be as Anandamoyi Ma was. Anandamoyi Ma was bothered by a fly, and her devotees were trying to chase it away. And she said, "No, this is a great saint who wanted to be close to this body." That's how Anandamoyi put it. And the fly just sat on her head, and she just let it sit there. Their lives are very short. Anandamoyi Ma said many odd things, but I am not capable of that, so I'm going to hope that the fly will leave us alone, because they actually make me quite nervous when they're fluttering around. So, having said that, let's see. If we can, there's one in the room. Let's see if we can go back to this. Anyway, Swami says to this man that it was exquisite, and the musician can have absolute confidence that that's really what Swami meant, because he would never have said that if it wasn't true. And then, of course, there's this wonderful balance point between inspiration and technical proficiency. If it is the musician that I think it probably is, you know, he's a great technician and is always concerned about doing it better. Whether it is him or not, that's a natural failing. But Swamiji wanted to remind him that it's the consciousness that you put into it. And even this great musician saying, if you're just thinking too much about the details, you miss the spirit. Swamiji used to say about Ananda a lot of the time, "I don't worry about the details." He said, "I look to see if the energy flow is right. Because if the energy flow is right," he said, "I know the details will take care of themselves." And you know, this for me personally was something that took me many years to learn. I used to get very stuck on the perfection of each small part. And it would cause me to be very blocked in my ability to produce very much. It was actually 20 years almost at Ananda before I was really able to get into a really creative flow. Because I began to understand that perfection is in the flow of energy. And if you think too much about the details, you stop the flow of energy. And then the energy either becomes choppy, self-conscious, or completely blocked. And that's just exactly what Swami is saying, to encourage this musician to, well, in another sense, to trust his heart. Just if your heart is there, then the rest of it will follow. Then he says, Swami says, "Indeed, excessive perfectionism indicates a pedestrian mind." He goes all the way there. "The arms of Krishna at the Jagannath Temple in Puri are truncated on purpose to symbolize the truth that the infinite can never be captured perfectly in form. They're sort of little stumpy. I've never seen them in person because they, at least insofar as I've ever been there, they don't allow Westerners into that church, that temple. They, non-Hindus, I guess is how you would put it. And our tour guide was appalled that we weren't let in, and he went and argued with the board there. And he said that we were more devout Hindus than most of the Indians that he knew. We were Americans from Ananda. But he said there was absolutely no chance that they would let us in. It's interesting that historically, in the life of Jesus, the part of the story is that Jesus argued with the priests at the Jagannath Temple because they were too narrow in their concepts. I mean, that's a lot of pieces put together. I think we're going to have to do something about these flies. Okay. See what you can do. Oops, not successful. Yeah, we're not following. There's the other one over there. Forgive me for having to do this. This is the opposite of masters. You might as well already kill it because you're killing it in your spirit. Swami said it's okay to kill flies. He said where they're allowed to proliferate, disease develops. So I must confess, and I'll just say it out loud, I have a very low capacity to endure flies. So now I believe those are the last two survivors of the invasion. I pray that they're the last two survivors. They hatch somewhere. I don't know where they live, but they hatch and they appear. Fortunately, only once or twice a year. So anyway, back at the Jagannath Temple, the images are very sort of odd. They're carved out of logs, and part of it is they don't have arms. And it's said for this reason, which is we can hint at the infinite in form, but we can't actually do it. But if the spirit is there, and there's a huge ritual, I won't go into the whole story of the Jagannath Temple, you can look it up and it's wonderful. I've never been inside of it, but I've been close to it. There's places where you can sort of see what's going on in the temple without going in. And I've been there multiple times and it's thrilling. These are ancient pilgrimage places with just profound and deep energy that are well worth the effort to get there. Not that anybody can go anywhere right now, but this is 2020 September. God willing, we'll be able to travel again soon. So now this, the last letter in this section is simply a Christmas thank you to all of Ananda. It's December 26, 1988. Dear ones, Swami says, I want to thank all of you for your many demonstrations of divine friendship this Christmas season. I am grateful, of course, for your presence, but also for your kind and happy smiles, for the love in your eyes, and for the joy I feel in your devotion to God, Christ, and Gurus. That's so sweet. And for the joy I feel in your devotion to God, Christ, and Gurus. I remember one year, I think it was Swami's birthday, someone wrote Swamiji a very heartfelt letter of gratitude. And the letter was, because of you, I've learned to love God. And the person just poured out what it meant to them to have been able to bring God so much closer into their hearts, to become a disciple of Master, and to understand on a deep level what that meant. It was very interesting because the man who wrote that note was very private, and it was a rather large group of people. Shy would be the word I would use, private and shy. And Swami opened that card and then read it out loud. And I think he was just trying to make that man be more at ease with expressing himself. But afterwards, after Swami read it, and he also read it for this reason, he said, that's the greatest gift that I could possibly receive, which is to know that my life has helped you to be closer to God. Swami himself described his life as having, he said, I have only two desires. That is to know God and to help others to know God. And everything he did, I mean, his life was so complicated and so full and so rich, but it really, that's all that he was ever doing. And in the complexity of it, he never saw the complexity of it. He just saw that he was following the path of trying to draw closer to God and to help others to draw closer to God, to realize God and help others to realize God. This is the divine simplicity of a saint. And so he says, I am grateful for your presence, but also for your kind and happy smiles, for the love in your eyes, and for the joy I feel in your devotion to God, Christ, and Gurus. To every one of you, I would like to say the same things. Thank you for your gift and for your love, and above all for the love of God that I felt shining through you. The actual nature of each gift is secondary to the deeper, less tangible reality of your friendship in divine friendship. Well, that was what he was like. I'll just turn the page. There's nothing more that can be said. Okay, now we are entering the section called Marriage and Renunciation. So that is really the question, isn't it? Marriage and renunciation. You know, how do we balance the fundamental demand of the spiritual path that we develop vairagya, which is a disinclination for the things of this world? How do we balance that against the compelling karma that almost everyone feels to be in close, intimate association with someone else, with others, and for most people, the need for a non-celibate, intimate relationship? How do we balance these? I think it's a fairly large section, and there's some really serious letters here. So this is written on April 30th, 1980. Just to keep things clear, Swamiji was a monastic, was a monk, from the time he met Master on September 12th, 1948, until around the spring of 1981, the year 1981, when he felt an inward call to become the example of a householder disciple at Ananda. And he began a relationship with a woman that took the name of Parameshwari. That relationship lasted less than a year, but it completely turned Ananda around. And Swami let go of the formal title Swami and became Sri Kriyananda. That relationship did not last, but soon after Swami met a beautiful Italian woman named Rosanna, beautiful because of her heart. She is a beautiful soul. And for about 7 years, he married her in 1985, and they were married for 7 years. In the end, she did not ever feel at home in America, and the demands of Swamiji's life were simply not compatible with her inner spirit. The demands placed upon Swamiji, and therefore upon their lives together, was not compatible with her inner spirit, and they separated. She went back to Italy for a time. She's lived in both countries. And so in 1998, I think it was, 97, Swamiji went to India. Would have been, let me just think about this. I think it was a 12-year cycle, so it might be 93. But in any case, he went to India, and he thought he would have to be reinitiated as a sannyasi. But when he went to India, he was told by various spiritual authorities that once you take the vow of sannyasi, you don't need to be reinitiated. So Swami simply reassumed it. All during that time, we called him Swami, because Swami is a formal title for someone who has taken the vow of sannyas. I'm a Swami. Our order is called Naya Swami because we're a new order, but I have the formal title of Swami. But Swami also means teacher. And so in the Indian spiritual tradition, it's common for the leader of an ashram or any spiritual guide to be called Swami. It's even actually apparently in Bengali a word for husband, but it just simply means teacher. So we as a community, had a long discussion in 1981, but we all agreed that even if Swami wasn't formally a sannyasi, he was still our teacher. And so we would continue to call him Swami in that light. But all his books and everything public you'll see for those years were just called Sri Kriyananda. So I say all that because this letter is April 30th, 1980, and so this was in the context of Swamiji living a monastic life. Some of these are, well, they're all different dates. That's just background for this whole story. So this is a letter to a person who is seeking a perfect mate. Perfect is in quotes. April 30th, 1980. Swami writes, "It is a mistake to think that you will ever find the perfect mate. Life outwardly cannot be other than compromise between the ideal and reality. This is true in every walk of life, even in the ashrams of saints, for the world is limited, relative, and otherwise conditioned in countless ways." When I remember, there was a time in the middle of Swami's life where his inclination to reincarnate at the end of this incarnation was very, very low. Vairagya was raging in his attitude, and Master had promised him absolute freedom at the end of this life. Actually, Master had said to him that he was already free, but the realization of that freedom would come at the end of his life. These are esoterics that are a little hard for me to understand, but I perceive Swamiji as a Jivan Mukta. I talk about this in Light Bearer, so I won't go into it here. And this is me a little bit beyond my portfolio, but trying to put together what I know. But at that period of time, Swami was not inclined toward coming back. But we were having this discussion as we were having it over lunch while we were traveling somewhere. And we had been particularly embroiled in some horrible thing or another. I don't even know what. But it all had to do with this being early Dwapara and the whole society just being operating at a level that was not congenial to our spirit. I remember a friend of mine, we were driving through town and there was a movie theater and it was showing a movie. It might have been, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is sort of the joke of the most horrible title, but it was a title like that. You know, death, violence, horrible, ickiness, ghastliness. And my friend just looked at the marquee, sort of read the title, and he said, "Imagine a planet in which people make movies like that and then other people pay to go see them." He said, "Imagine such a place. We're living on it." You know, it was just like, how did we get here? Like, why would we ever want to expose ourselves to something so crass? So it was something like that had happened. I don't even know what. And so I said to Swamiji, "Sir, the next time you incarnate, could we please wait until Satya Yuga?" This is the Satya Yuga is the highest in the Yuga cycles. I said, this early Dwapara is just really getting me down. I really don't want to do this again. Swami's first response, which was very instantaneous, was, "I never intend to come back." Later on, in a separate conversation, I was on the phone with him, and he said something about a disinclination to come back. And I said, "Sir, but..." Let's see, how did it go exactly? He said, "Oh, the Swami said, I never..." In this other conversation, you know, a disinclination to come back. He said, "The only thing that could bring me back would be to help all of you." I said, "Sir, that's the only reason you came this time, isn't it?" He said, "Well, there is that, isn't there?" And by years later, he was just saying, "I'll come back as often as needed if I can help any of you come closer to God." Swamiji had, by that point, was so himself in such a bliss state that it made no difference to him. If he could help, he would help. But in this situation, to come back, first he said he wasn't coming back. And then he said, here's the interesting point. He said, "Satya Yuga is still the material plane." He said, "It's not God realization. It's still the material plane with all the limitations and compromises inherent." He said, "The only difference is people like us are in charge." That's what he said. I said, "So the whole planet is like Ananda." He said, "Yes. The whole planet operates like Ananda, with integrity, with devotion to God, with honesty, with friendship, with loyalty. I mean, all the qualities that make us who we are, make our little ray of grace what it is. The whole world is at that level." But he said, and he said it very seriously, "It's still the material plane. And the material plane is locked in Maya. And it's bound by duality. He said the only perfection is in God. So this is what he says here. You know, life outwardly cannot be other than compromise between the ideal and reality. This is true of every walk of life, even in the ashrams of saints. For the world is limited, relative, and otherwise conditioned in countless ways. That's not really a cynical statement. That's just a realization of what is. At different times, Swami would say things, and I want to make a comment here, because he made a very important point. Sometimes Swami would make sweeping statements that people would take as generalizations. And I remember this man, when Swami was writing Revelations of Christ, and he says in there, he makes some sweeping statements about the state of the Christian churches or the state of Christianity in the world today. And this man was very defensive about the state of Christianity. And he wrote back to Swami. Swami sent him the manuscript because Swami solicits people's opinion. He knew that the man would be somewhat negatively inclined, but that's, you don't want to just send your manuscript to people who say it's great. You want to send it to people who are going to point out the weaknesses in it also. And I think Swami did it to help that man. But he wrote back, you know, you're generalizing. And then the man wrote a whole bunch of, you know, these are the exceptions to what you said. And then Swami's answer was extremely interesting. He said, I'm not generalizing. He said, of course, if you generalize, there are always exceptions. And he said also, you can never actually make a statement if you're just going to talk about all the exceptions. He said, I'm talking about the essential quality. The essential quality. I'm describing the essence. This is the essence that characterizes this attitude. And yes, of course, there are always exceptions, but we're trying to talk about the essential quality, and then therefore we can have a discussion because this is the essential quality. So when Swami says, you know, the world is limited, relative, and otherwise conditioned in countless ways, people who are upset by something like that, and this has happened to me, and this has certainly happened to Swami, oh, there's many beautiful things about this world. Yes, it's true. But the essence of this world is that it's limited, relative, and otherwise conditioned in countless ways. When I was first starting on the path, Swami's generalizations used to annoy me, what I felt were generalizations, because they scared me. I didn't want to be told that this world is limited and conditioned. I just wanted to, I didn't want my ideals to have to compromise with reality. Just what, how does he put it? Is cannot be other than a compromise between the ideal and reality. Now, bear in mind, there is an answer to this, and he gives it in the next sentence. Seek perfection, therefore, within yourself, because the ideal that we all know is there, is there. It's just that it's within ourselves. The more you depend on outer circumstances to give you perfection, the more you will find disappointment. And then he says, remember too, that your path to perfection depends not only on inner growth, but on the application of that inner growth to outer circumstances. In other words, a relationship that seems lacking in personal fulfillment may be a great spiritual blessing, for the opportunity it gives one to be a channel for divine love and service to help the other person. It is more blessed to give than to receive. Service and sacrifice, not outward fulfillment, are the essence of spiritual development. Now, before you run off and make a dogma out of that, to suffer is not necessarily God's will. So don't think just because it's a terrible relationship, therefore it's the right one for you. Common sense is also required in this. Now, there was a thought that was in my mind. Let me see. Oh, yes. I won't name names in this, and I'll tell you this was a story that happened a long time ago. Swamiji has on occasion made the statement that any two sincere devotees ought to be able to live happily together. Ideal often meets reality on that one. One of my friends who married another devotee, and they weren't a good marriage partnership, let's just put it like that. And this happened many years ago, so you don't even have to try to guess who it was. But he was standing up and giving a public talk. And I was listening to him, and I saw that somehow or another he was working himself into a position to have to explain why he got divorced. Why he and his marriage partner, they were friends before they were married, and they were very good friends after they divorced. As he himself said, we're very good friends, we were just not a good marriage. But he was getting himself into this position where he was going to have to explain about getting divorced. And I'm watching him just sitting there wondering, how is he ever going to handle this? And then I see it crosses his mind what he's gotten himself into. So he handled it absolutely beautifully. He said, Swami Kriyananda says that any two sincere devotees ought to be able to be happily married to each other. Well, my friend and I experimented, and we decided that at least in our case, this wasn't true. I met him later in the market, and I stood up and I gave him a standing ovation of one. I said, that was brilliant. He said, well, it was also the truth. But it was just, so there is a reality to this also, that merely because theoretically this is what's going on, we have to be realistic about our own capabilities. This is what I have to mean. There have been more separations and divorces, that Ananda Swami says, than he would like to see. But all of us are the product of the society we've grown up in, and this is what we're working with, and we all have to be realistic. And Swami has also said, he said, merely to remain married to the end of the incarnation is not necessarily a spiritual victory. But to this person, he was trying to say, whoever it is, you need to be realistic. You just have this idea in your mind, and you need to find a connection between this romantic dream you have and what's really going to happen, which is why in the very first sentence, you know, it's a mistake to think you'll ever find the perfect mate. You know, the world is limited, relative, and otherwise conditioned in countless ways. Swamiji is inviting this person to come into a proper relationship. There's a story in Swami Kriyananda, as we've known him, which seems apt for this point. It was a woman. The story was told by a woman. I believe the story is anonymous in there, I'm pretty sure. If it isn't, I'll just leave it. Anyway, somehow or another, she was very eager to be married. And she read some, you know, manifestation guidelines that if you want to have a perfect relationship, you should be extremely specific in your demands. So she became extremely specific, and she wrote out 3 pages of qualifications for who she wanted to be her marriage partner. Very deep and sincere devotee, just like that. And I really don't know how it happened, but somehow or another she showed these to Swamiji. She was, you know, she was a friend of his. She showed these pages of qualifications. He read them. Swami's so respectful. He read them carefully, and then he sort of looked at her like this as she told the story to me. He said, my dear, what you have described here is Jesus Christ, and Jesus would not marry you. Fortunately, she had a good sense of humor. And he said, furthermore, even if he would, you would not be happy with him. He said, you need someone a little closer to your own level. So she heard him, and she went and she wrote 2 things. Let's see. She wanted someone who loved God and who had a good sense of humor. And she said very shortly after that, she met the man she married. She's been very happily married to him for a very long time. And she also laughs because his birthday is the same as Jesus's birthday, which was God's little joke to her. So there we are. You know, we have to balance all of these factors and live in the world as the world really is. That's why the second sentence of this is, this world is limited and is always conditioned. It was very direct advice to this person. You need to become realistic. Jesus would not marry you. Okay, so now, then he says, no, I've already finished that. So now this is June 23rd, 2000. So by now, Swamiji has been through his example of householder life, which is what he did, and he set an example for householder life that basically set Ananda on the right course, because part of what was happening in 1980 and 81, as Swami put it, is that householders were beginning to feel like second-class citizens, and the monasteries were swelling with a lot of people who were very sincere spiritually, but the monastic life really wasn't the right life for them. They really needed to be more themselves rather than trying to force themselves into some kind of a mold because they thought it was the superior spiritual path. Ananda was falling into the worst trap that people fall into, which is instead of doing what I feel inwardly guided to do, I'm doing what I think I ought to do. So when Swamiji took up a householder life, it sort of gave everyone, and his explanation for it was, I felt Master wanted me to do it. And so it suddenly everybody started asking, what do I feel inwardly guided to do, not what ought I to do? And Ananda just completely turned around at that point, and we exhaled, and people started being more natural, which was really what was needed at that point. So anyway, but by now Swamiji has gone back to being a sannyasi, which, as he says, is really a more natural life for him. So this is a rather long letter, and it's philosophical, and it's very interesting, and I doubt if we'll finish it tonight. So the summary of this letter is relationships aren't created, they exist already, which I'm not sure that's a perfect summary, but it's interesting. June 23rd, 2000. I have no idea what prompted this answer, but it's very interesting. People nowadays use the word relationships mostly as a synonym for romantic relationships. Needless to say, there are many other kinds of relationships in the world, and not only human either. In the broadest sense, the word relationships refers to all outer relationships the ego has with maya, or delusion, and includes all outer relationships between one ego and another. The relationship not only with friends, but also with casual strangers, with those who hate us, or even seek our destruction, with family and neighbors, even with animals. It also refers to a person's feeling of relationship with the universe and everything in it. So what Swami's really saying here is, as long as we are identified with the ego, then we see ourselves as independent and separate. And Keshava, there's another giant fly that is going to be buzzing around. So we are going to pause, and we are all going to wish this fly a speedy transition into its next incarnation. Yes, there it goes. I believe it's gone. Thank you. I have to actually say that my relationship to flies is extreme. But there you have it. It is. Okay? When they're near me, I was... Today, because they've been just hatching all the time and flying around everywhere, I have a big monitor, a computer monitor, and I have my little laptop, and I was scrolling on the laptop, you know, and how the little arrow moves, this little black arrow? The little black arrow began to freak me out. That was when I realized I'd really crossed over into some other reality here. I'm not quite sure what they represent to me, but I frankly admit they make me very nervous. Okay, but what Swami is saying here, in the broadest sense, the word relationships to everything that we relate to in maya. Because once we identify as an ego, what we've done identifying as an ego is that we have created a separate reality for ourselves. And as soon as we have a separate reality, we are not one with anything. So everything has to be a relationship because everything is other than us. I mean, it's a very interesting way to state it. That's why Swami says, relationships aren't created, they exist already. We live in a state of relationship. It's interesting, when I used to teach the Meditation 1 classes, the beginning meditation classes, which I did years ago, literally decades ago, when this colony was first starting, I used to teach a lot of those classes, and I had a certain pattern. I was pretty free-flowing. But one of the classes that was very important to me to get across to people, meditation is a relationship. You are relating to an actual consciousness that in the strictest Vedantic sense is not separate from you, but in common sense experience, because you are identified with your ego, God feels separate to us. And so what I wanted people to understand is meditation is not just this dry solitary practice where I'm only inside myself. This is a relationship where there's two of you. It's a love affair. And that's what it feels like. And that's in essence what Swami's talking about here. You know, we are in relationship to everything around us. And that's just a beginning point for picking it up from the right string. Otherwise, we try to, if we don't have a clear fundamental idea of what we're talking about, it's very hard to be clear all the way through. And so this is what he's suggesting. We start from this. This is the basic nature of things. Animals, friends, enemies, we're in relationship to all of it. Lifting the word relationship out of the category of romantic involvements enables us to see that the word refers also to vast and exciting spiritual discoveries. The realization that throughout all existence, a relationship already exists. As the Irish poet A.E. said, Swami says, I'm forced to paraphrase here, the least movement of my finger has an effect on the most distant star. We are united not only with one another, friend and foe equally, though in different ways, but also with all that is. Oh my, doesn't that just really take it out to a much farther level? Now, a person's loneliness or longing for intimacy is not necessarily assuaged by this kind of philosophy, but it does help. And it also just puts our little ego in context. As we struggle feeling lonely, as we struggle feeling small, we are a part of all that is. We are in relationship to all that is. I move my finger and the farthest star is affected. I remember a Buddhist teacher talking about her learning about karma and how she just couldn't quite comprehend the law of karma, how things were interrelated and how my action affects this. And she was an American woman, and she had a family, and she had a grandchild. And she was scheduled to give a talk, and either she had a cold when she arrived for that talk, or she had to cancel it because she got a bad cold. And she got a bad cold, as she was explaining later, because her grandchild had a cold, and her grandchild sneezed in her face. And as a consequence, she picked up the germs from the grandchild. She herself got sick. It affected her commitment. All the people in the audience were affected. You know, just it went on like that. So she started thinking, how did I come to be holding my grandchild? Well, of course, I wouldn't be holding a grandchild unless I'd had a child. And in her case, she said, I would never have had a child if I hadn't met my husband. And I would never have met my husband if I hadn't gone to that particular college and gone to that particular bookstore on that particular day to buy that particular book for that particular class. And then, of course, he had a whole series of things that brought him to that point. She gets all the way back to Adam and Eve before she could cut it. There was no place to cut it because absolutely everything was in relationship to everything else. I mean, this is what the physicists are all telling us. Now, I can't say it in those terms. My friend Joseph Selby has written The Physics of God, and now he has another book that he's about to come out with where he really takes all this from a scientific and a spiritual point of view. Joseph Selby, I highly recommend his book and his new book coming out. I wish I could remember the name of it, but it's wonderful. But in any case, that's where we are. We're in relationship to everything. Now, we may single out this one person and try to make something else happen right here, but it's still happening in context. And this is what Swami's also talking about. We take the word relationship and draw a circle about this romantic thing and then try to have it exist as like this unique, separate, this is what a relationship is. And it's very confusing and does not generally lead to happiness. That's all I'll say. We'll get to that more in a little bit later, but that's also part of it. We are also united with spirit, as Meister Eckhart said, I move my hand, and Christ moves, who is my hand. He was saying that divine union on that level of reality exists already, and so it did, at least in his case, meaning in his state of realization. For most people, however, and now he's separating, we're united in spirit, we're united with all of the universe, we're in relationship to everything that is. And then now Swami brings it back to the question that was asked him. For most people, however, relationship implies two separate entities seeking and exploring an underlying oneness, and this is his phrase, that still needs to be affirmed. So here we are in relation to the whole universe, and all of us are children of God, and on a higher level, we're all already united in the spirit. But relationships are two separate entities. I love it. Exploring an underlying oneness that still needs to be affirmed. That is there in principle and in theory and in philosophy, but is not yet experienced. And this is where Meister Eckhart could say, I move my hand and Christ moves, who is my hand? And I can repeat that exquisitely beautiful statement. And I can move my hand while I do it. And I know that for Meister Eckhart, he saw Christ. I see my hand. This is the reality of who I am. I can be inspired by it, but it's a oneness that still has to be affirmed. And so that's what Swami's talking about. And he says, this is true even between self-defined enemies. Two separate entities relating to each other, exploring a oneness that still has to be affirmed in the course of self. And I love the way Swami says that, self-defined enemies. He doesn't say just enemies, because Swami doesn't accept the reality that two people are actually enemies. They have just defined themselves as enemies. And when you think about the enmity that exists between people in this world, there's a lot of self-defined enemies. Swami always referred to the people who were bent on his destruction, of which there was a determined coterie. As he called them self-styled enemies. He didn't want to affirm that that was even their self-definition. Self-styled. They've styled themselves as my enemy. But he would never, ever acknowledge that they were. They were just his self-styled enemies. That was their definition, and he had to acknowledge it as their definition, but that's all. So even because it's another aspect of this which is really interesting, which is nobody really becomes your enemy unless you care about them. Because somebody else who's out there just doing terrible things, it has to come into your sphere. And sometimes you consider someone an enemy when they haven't even done anything to you that you remember. But it's very interesting how love can turn to hate, love that's based on attachment. I heard that so often, and I couldn't really figure it out, but it's really obvious. You love someone, and your love is not completely pure. You want something from them. And maybe for a time they give it to you and you become very close, whatever it might be. But then something happens. A flaw emerges in their character. They change astrological periods. You know, a karmic bomb goes off in their life. And suddenly they're not able to provide, to give to you in the same way that they were before. Now you've come to rely on them and come to expect that this is how they're going to treat you. But something happens in their life that makes it difficult. And first there's disappointment and sadness, but very often what comes later is intense anger. How dare you? Because desire leads to infatuation. Infatuation leads to the belief that one object and only one object can make me happy. Desire disappointed leads to anger. Anger leads to the loss of judgment. All discrimination is lost. The Gita says it more succinctly, but that's what it says. So I loved you profoundly. You may even have loved me, but you moved in another direction and I didn't want you to. So now I'm so mad at you. I'm so angry and I didn't get my satisfaction in one life and I'm just going to keep trying to get it. There is a question that I answered in my book, Ask Asha. Ask Asha is a very good book, I would have to suggest to you. I happen to be the author of it. It's little known and little respected, but it deserves a lot more good attention than it gets. I'll just say that about it. I'm quite surprised when I look at it how good it is. It's just the teachings. I mean, it's not. I wrote down in a very clear way what Swami taught me, and it's worth reading. But I got this question. These were all real questions in that book. And the question was about karma. The question was about do I have to marry this woman again?
And it took me a little while to parse through what the man was actually asking me. But basically, the man felt that one lifetime with her was enough. And she was really determined that he was going to marry her again and again. And he kind of was trying to find out whether he had to do that or not. And he was an honorable man. It's just that she wanted to marry him again, and he didn't. And so I just talked about how you work out karma and how you don't have to be bound by other people's demands on you. If there's something more for you to learn, then go ahead and learn it. But just because somebody else wants it doesn't mean you have to conform to their desires. But I imagined how that one could go in future incarnations. She meets him. She really wants to marry him. He really knows that he doesn't want to marry her again. He disappoints her. She feels really betrayed. And you're off to the races again. Self-defined enemies. It's very, very, wow, let me go back. Let's see. For the world is limited, relative, and otherwise conditioned in countless ways. So, he says, in superconsciousness and in God realization, relationship is not something to seek or to be created, but only something to be realized on ever deeper levels. The unity exists already. See, once we move out of Maya, once we move into superconsciousness, once we move into God realization, we're just simply in a state of oneness. Relationship isn't there anymore. So even though, as I was saying, in meditation when we start, there is a relationship, but as that relationship develops, and this is a state of realization that I don't have, but this is what all the saints promise us, that the distinction between I and thou disappears, and there is only one. Swami made the extremely interesting statement. He said, at the moment that you, of God realization, when you realize that there is only one, that there is only one single reality in creation, he said, there's a moment of intense loneliness. A fascinating statement. I have no experience of it, but it's beautiful. He said, which is almost immediately replaced by a state of bliss, which is that first there's just this, I've merged in and there's only one reality. But then one realizes, Swami says, that that single reality is bliss. And then all concern obviously disappears. So, relationship in God realization and superconsciousness. Relationship is not something you seek or to be created, but something that is realized on ever deeper level. The unity exists already. The relationship enjoyed in that unity, like a great saint delighting in the worship of God, is not a search, but a reaffirmation, and finally, a rediscovery that can be enjoyed ever newly through all eternity. Well, I think a person could spend a long time just meditating on that paragraph. A reaffirmation, then a rediscovery of ever new joy. This was Master's definition of our experience of God, that we just keep experiencing it and it's ever new. There's a very interesting passage in a letter from Master to Rajasi. Rajasi was Master's most advanced disciple. He was in a state of samadhi. He was in a state of God realization. And Master was writing to Rajasi about various things that Master could experiment with when he was meditating, different ways of enjoying the presence of God. And there's a meditation diary, journals, that Lahiri Mahashaya kept. And Lahiri Mahashaya just spent, you know, days and nights just sitting in meditation in his living room after he retired from his job. He spent years just in a state of bliss with God. And he wrote down all the different experiments that he could do in that state of consciousness. Just even the very idea of that, it's ever new joy. So I don't know how to even visualize what that means, but those comments that much happens in that state, but you're not creating a relationship. You're just constantly rediscovering it. Someday we'll understand, won't we? In that context, what is romantic love? Remember, the only real lover is God. There simply is no love outside of him or her as the Divine Mother. It doesn't exist. Thus, romantic love is actually a delusion. It promises everything and gives little, indeed, almost nothing. And the little it does give melts away in time like snowflakes on a hot day. Well, that's a rather sweeping generalization that we don't want to hear, so let's go on from there. Human love is fleeting and disappointing. It is a kind of emotional release. And then Swami writes in all caps, unless. Unless it is self-giving, not grasping. Unless it seeks fulfillment in the joy of another, not selfishly in one's own self. It is fulfilling when it is sought, not by making demands, but in inner freedom. It is fulfilling when it is based primarily on soul friendship, not on bodily, emotional, or intellectual demands. And it is true only when it is completely unconditional. Now, being realistic, the reason we, most people, are deeply compelled toward romantic partnerships is because we have to learn this. So it's not like, you know, this is who I'm going to be, but this is who I aspire to be, and this is my opportunity to practice. And so romantic relationships, intimate personal relationships, can be deeply fulfilling because if there is strong enough inner strength in one or both parties, preferably in both, that we actually understand what we're doing and that we live correctly. Is this easy? Oh, no, absolutely not. Is this even common? No. I'll tell you an interesting experience that I had. I was witness to this. This woman who was involved with this man in the community, and you know, their relationship looked like it might have promise. There was no reason to think it wouldn't, but they didn't get along really well. They sort of struggled and fought against each other, and he was making demands on her that she didn't want to meet, and they seemed unreasonable, and they did seem unreasonable. And she was talking to Swami, but her concern was, I would call it superstitious. She was afraid that, you know, he was the one, the sort of the cosmic one destined to be her partner. And if she broke up with him, as all common sense would recommend that she do, that she would be missing the boat in some way. So Swami tried to help her in what I can only call a common sense way. It's nice to say, I will be utterly selfless and I will be totally unconcerned with my fulfillment. But if you're not at that level, you can't say that. And you just, not only do you make yourself and your partner miserable, but you create a crazy complex because you're not authentic about your reality. So this woman was caught in some of that. And Swami was very kind to her and helped her as much as he could, and she went on her way. After she left, for some reason, I must have been in the room or I came in right after. And he said to me really simply, because she had spoken of a certain relationship that she'd seen within Ananda, which was exemplary and unique. Well, not unique, but certainly exemplary. And she had sort of, she spoke of wanting a relationship like that. Swami said to me, he said, you have to have very, 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 very good karma to have a relationship like that. And he said, this woman, and he put it like this, she has so many lessons to learn, she could learn them with any number of people. He said, you have to be very advanced before your karma comes down to something so narrow as this is the only one. And even that thought was, in her case, not paying attention to the real issue, which was her consciousness, not his, but hers. What was she trying to do? Who was she? What was her own attitude? How giving was she? How calm? What kind of deep understanding? as Swami said, which was true. She has so many lessons to learn. She could learn them with any number of people. It's going to be, that's how he put it, it's going to be many incarnations before she has the karma that comes down as precisely as she wants it to come down now. This is the good news. I mean, we just have to work it out, friends, and generationally, and especially in America, but for the whole world, this is what we're working on. So now Swami asks, can such love be a path to transformation? Only to the extent that it inspires selflessness, kindness, generosity, loyalty, and a self-expansion that includes another person's happiness, than that of increasing numbers of other people's happiness in one's own. In this sense only has this always been an important teaching in Hinduism. The Hindu scriptures say that this must have been a question that they asked about the Indian attitude toward marriage, I guess. The Hindu scriptures say that the wife and husband should love one another, not only for each other's sake, but for the sake of God who dwells within them both. It's a beautiful way to put it, isn't it? They should love each other not only for each other's sake, but for the sake of God who dwells within them both. But then, of course, we have to learn that kind of selflessness. And that kind of selflessness can only come from a very deep inner relationship with God. And a very deep inner relationship with God can only come after we've smoothed off the edges of our karma. And the smoothing of the edges of our karma can only come when our karma compels us into close relationships that cause the edges of us to bang up against the edges of someone else. So welcome to the human race. I mean, this is what we're working with. Nothing is automatic. I think I was saying in an earlier broadcast this very day, but a great deal of the counseling over the years that I've had to offer people, spiritually speaking, is to help them understand that there's nothing wrong with you at all. You're not failing. You're not even messing up. You're just being yourself. And this is who you are. You know, you have deep needs that are not yet fulfilled in God. And you need experiences in order to grow deeper in your relationship with God. Me, us, we. This is not you, this is us. This is what happens. And we haven't failed. We're just finishing the picture. You don't look at a painting that's not quite finished and call it finished. That's us. It's just as simple as that. I'm not finished. This is what it looks like when I'm half-baked. You know, when you take the loaf of bread out of the oven, before it's finished, it's not very good. But you would realize that it has to go back in the oven. And that's us. You know, we go into the oven of many, for many people, intimate relationships. We cook for a while. And eventually we're done. And this is what it looks like when we're done. And that's how we can tell in right relationship. See, what Swami's straightening out here, and this is the first letter, you think you're going to get this perfect relationship? There is no perfect relationship. Relationships are an opportunity for us to develop perfection. But we have to be working at a level that we can work with. We don't want to be in kindergarten when we should be in high school, and we can't be in graduate school when we should be in high school. That's what he was saying about that woman. She has so much to learn. She can learn it just about anywhere. She just needs to get her edges rubbed off before she will have the karma to attract to herself what she knows is possible, but not yet possible for her. The practical application of this is a whole other story, but that's not what we're talking about now. And there's many places where that's described. So now this must be also a question that was asked by the letter. Can I give examples from my own life and or from those I've counseled or known in this life as to how relationships and the issues that come up in them can be worked with and lead to a higher clarity and knowledge of the self? The answer, Swami says, is yes. Intimate relationships especially force us to face ourselves. Instead of blaming anyone else, we should think, what does this interpersonal problem tell me about how I can change and improve myself? Never blame the other person, but don't blame yourself either. Blame, you see, is useless. look on every difficulty as an opportunity, not for changing the other person, but for self-improvement. As for examples, I suppose 1,000 could come to mind, but the brief sentences in this paragraph are a condensation of all of them, and are more real to me than any specific episode could possibly be. Intimate relationships give us the opportunity to mirror within ourselves what is it that I'm trying to learn. And I don't have to blame myself for not being cooked yet, finished yet, nor should I blame the person who's close to me for behaving according to their own nature and then having that upset me. Now, again, we have to be practical. Sometimes we find ourselves in a situation that just isn't possible. I remember when a couple was separating and Swami said, basically, you've taken it as far as you can take it in this incarnation. He said, maybe the karma is over. And then he said, but I don't think so. But you both have to grow in other ways before you're going to be able to find harmony between yourselves or harmony with someone who represents you if the other person has changed in such a way. But that was just very simple. We've taken it as far as we can go. This is what I often say to people, to have any creative energy left. And sometimes people just say, no, I'm just at the end. I can't go any farther. There's nothing that can be done. That's just reality. So ultimately, all the same, these all relate to improving the personality, which is nothing but a mask for the self. As aids to knowledge of the self, they serve only to the extent that they teach us to stop thinking of ourselves, to stop wanting for ourselves, and to realize that all relationships are reminders of that one self of which all of us are inextricably a part. It's an interesting paragraph. You know, all you're working with is your outer self. Swami says much earlier, you have to take your inner realizations and apply them to the outer world. That was in the earlier letter when he says we're all in relationships and your relationships with the world outside are the opportunity to prove what Gaudamata called in the cold light of day. When you're just sitting all by yourself, you can feel like you really have you're really in order and the philosophy is really who you are. But then when you're in close association with someone and lose your temper and feel hurt and get angry because of the way someone's treating you, all of a sudden you've learned something you didn't know. And you might never learn if you were alone, which is why our karma pushes us into this. But ultimately, there's the point where we just don't need it anymore. And in the Holy Science Master, Sri Yukteswar talks about that. He talks about the progressive stages of purification of the heart and the higher stages of the five or so that he names are when one is capable of finishing the job in solitude, that it's just not necessary to have it mirrored back to me anymore, that all of that of getting along with others is an outer expression, and one can move deeply into the inner self. And who we are as a personality becomes completely irrelevant. It just doesn't matter. When you're there, you'll know it, so you don't have to worry about it. Okay. The danger of all relationships, spiritually speaking, is that they hold present experiences up so close that we are tempted to confuse them with reality. Oh, dear. That was my word, oh dear, Swami didn't say that, I said that. The benefit of relationships, spiritually speaking, is that the more we can learn to maintain our heart's equanimity in the face of every test, and relationship tests are among the greatest that people experience, meaning the most powerful, not necessarily the most wonderful, but I suppose the most powerful are also the most wonderful. The more we can remain, as Paramahansa Yogananda often put it, unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. So he says, we hold the present experience up so close that we confuse it with reality. So among Swami's small advice for married couples is he said, never say never. Never say you always. That's how he put it. Never say you always. You always respond to me like that. You take the present reality and you hold it up so close. Present experiences, and you hold it so close that you mistake it for reality. The fact that a person has upset you, You think, therefore, your whole world is crashing around you. You mistake the present experience for reality. And that's what happens because we get so invested. And the benefit is that we learn not to do that, that we learn to just remain calmly in the self no matter what comes. This is very high-level success, but that's what Swami's talking about here. Remember, the basic reality of the universe, the fundamental reality of all existence, is duality. For everything, there is, without exception, an opposite. The more we allow ourselves to be elated by joyful emotions, the more we are bound to attract and to be susceptible to emotions of suffering. The one follows the other like the phases of the moon. In any relationship, fulfillment will come not in momentary highs, but only in calm giving from one's inner self to all. So sometimes we seek intensity, we identify with that intensity, we really want that intensity, and then inevitably, when infatuation begins to wane, familiarity begins to set in, and it's different. And people who think that I have to keep having that high of emotion, then we decide this relationship is over, and we go and we start another one. We look for it. Fulfillment comes in the calm self-giving. And you have to experience it to understand that there's just no other way. And you have to be realistic in the learning. Swami says, I've covered these matters in my book, Expansive Marriage. Now, Swamiji changed the name of Expansive Marriage into Self-Expansion Through Marriage. And I know that he changed the name, and he refers here to part of the reason he changed the name, which I had never really heard. I have covered these matters in my book, Expansive Marriage, which is not, as I'm afraid some people may expect, a manual on wife swapping. Somehow he must have found out that it was being misunderstood. But it's a book on soul expansion and on self-giving and self-sharing with one spouse and with all others. The book is now called Self-Expansion Through Marriage, just to make it clear. He said, I've also covered them to some extent, though more indirectly, in my book, Awaken to Superconsciousness. I hope the above answers will prove useful. So there you have it, friends. It's a pretty big story, isn't it? I know Swamiji, he was motivated by whoever wrote to him. A person must have written to him, and I have no idea who it was, really needing a really deep understanding. Perhaps it was somebody who needed to help others in this matter, although I feel like there was also a personal need in this. This is a letter, if this is an area of interest to you, I think this is a letter really worth reading and meditating on. I can just really see Swamiji picked this up from a very clear and a very high perspective. And the balance point in all of spiritual life is just to never let go of our aspiration, but to move through that aspiration in a way that keeps us keeps our feet on the ground. And what I mean by that is not just common sense, which is very important, but keeps our feet on the ground in the sense that we can actually understand what my next step is. And that's why my friend's, you know, just sort of happy acceptance in public of the experiment of his marriage, which ended in divorce, was, well, I know that this is what Swami said, and that any two sincere devotees, and they're deeply sincere devotees, both of them, should be happy together, but it just didn't turn out to be true. And just the ease with which he just said that, you know, this was the theory, we experimented with the theory, and he was even saying, I'm still willing to believe it's true, but in our particular case, it didn't prove to be true. So we can still hold up for ourselves the possibility that we will rise to this, because we will rise to this, and that longing will be fulfilled, and we'll achieve it. This is where Swami says, don't blame your spouse, don't blame your partner, but don't blame yourself either. What are you supposed to blame yourself for? I'm 6 years old, and I behave like a six-year-old. I should just berate myself because I'm not 27? I mean, how is that going to help? Because that's 100% of what we're doing, and that's what I mean to keep your feet on the ground. I know that I'm going over there, but to get to there, I have to go through each of these stages. So we have to just see, oh, look, I'm not really as good at this as I thought I was. I need to practice. Oh, look, I'm better at this than I thought I was. That's a comfort to me. I can build on that. And then we just move step by step through this, not without kerfuffle, emotional kerfuffle, sometimes social kerfuffle. But what choice do we have, friends? This is the life that's given to us. This is the opportunity that God has given us. Let us stand together as friends and stand together with the divine and move together into the light. God bless you, my friends.